and welcome to Dialect. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week we take a retrospective of the festival scene and see how it's changed over the years, ending with this rather commercial monstrosity called Glastonbury. Also, Vicky Hancher talks cancer. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. I'll repeat the number at the end of the show. But first this week, I'm joined by Vicky Hancher to talk about cancer. Now, Vicky, first of all, just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got interested in the subject.
Well, I'm a holistic therapist. I trained as a reflexologist, aromatherapist, non-medical nutrition back in 2006. And I've kind of accumulated a whole host of therapies from that. And I was just fascinated at the fact that we could all have a massage once a week, and our health would be massively better, and we wouldn't need to take painkillers and pharmaceutical products. And what I found was a lot of people that were coming in with medical issues, the first thing we had to deal with was dealing with the toxicology of some of the tablets that were being prescribed by the doctor.
Now, we've heard recently, haven't we, about statins. I'm very, very sceptical about these, and I would warn all listeners really to possibly moderate the amount you're taking, because there's a lot of guff talked about just how dangerous cholesterol is. Apparently it's also rather natural and normal for many people to have it. One of the main impetuses through our news channels, through the media, etc., is of course the profits the pharmaceutical industry get by getting people to take these pills day after day after day. So just give us an idea of your take, Vicky, on the power of the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, it's vast, and I think there's a lot of analogies that we use about going down the rabbit hole and take the red pill or the blue pill, but it's definitely a case of, as soon as you realise the amount of deceit in not just this area but every area of mainstream media that we're provided information on, it's very limited and it's pretty much backwards. Everything that they tell us is good for us is bad for us, and everything that they say is bad for us is good for us. Like you say, I mean, full diet things, anything that's diet is generally full of aspartame, which is a lot of your listeners will know is a very toxic substance that causes nothing but problems.
Well, I would say, for example, look at a lot of the sweet drinks, that kind of thing, fizzy drinks have got us on the side of the can, will have maybe aspartame, or it sometimes says a source of phenylalanine. This stuff is nasty, isn't it?
I encourage all of your listeners to do their own research, and once you do open that Pandora's box, you'll see how nasty it is. And it's disgusting that they're putting everything. I mean, I went to go and get dehydration powder when I went abroad, just to please my mum at the time, just to know that I wasn't going to get dehydrated abroad. Went into the baby section in Boots, and to my horror, it had aspartame in the dehydration powder that was used for under 6 months old children.
So what is the effect of this aspartame then?
It affects the nervous system. It causes everything from epilepsy to all sorts of adverse reactions. There are different people that make different claims on it, and obviously I don't want to make any medical claims, but the research is vast. It affects the nervous system, and it has massive implications on people's health, especially on the nervous system, especially on the brain activity.
Yeah, and especially on youngsters as they're growing up. So try and keep them away from that stuff. It's incredible, isn't it, really, that these are licensed. But, of course, for something like aspartame, an artificial sweetener, a company that makes it, manufactures it, I think it was Monsanto that dreamt it up, they make an absolute fortune out of selling this. So there's a big financial imperative, incentive on them to get the government to license it. And we all know just how sometimes weak our governments can be in those sort of situations when they're being lobbied hard. But let's get back to cancer. And I want to just get a little bit from you, Vicky, about, you know, some sort of alternative approaches that you would recommend. I'm not, you know, we're not asking for medical advice here, but, you know, other avenues that people could explore as potential ways of, you know, actually creating the kind of lifestyle, the kind of diet that would preclude perhaps people getting cancer, because there's a lot of nasty stuff out there which can be carcinogenic, which actually is supposed to be officially okay for us.
Well, the first thing I'd suggest to everybody is to do their due diligence. If, I mean, the word cancer is so scary, and the first thing that anybody thinks when they think of cancer is obviously the worst. And it's a very scary, it's a whole industry of fear, fear, fear. And there's a lot of people who suffer with dormant cancers, and then as soon as they're diagnosed, their health goes down rapidly because of the things like neuro-linguistic programming, which we know can be used for good or bad. As soon as you're told about something like cancer, we're kind of so into the fear mentality all of a sudden, we scare ourselves into making ourselves more ill. So due diligence and research is the first thing that I'd suggest. Looking at our diet and preventative medicine, I mean, this is a vital, in my opinion, and I don't know how we became a culture that has detached nutrition from our health industry. I think we're in a society that's trying to constantly put a band-aid over the issue and not deal with the actual cause. And if we're constantly feeding ourselves things that are carcinogenic, as well as toxic thoughts, toxic emotions, not doing much exercise or physical activity, and there's no wonder over a period of time our body is going to react in an adverse way, because we're forcing it over a long period of time we're kind of forcing ourselves into a corner of bad food, bad thoughts, and the result is cancer is one of many diseases that is just long-term result of poor health. Diet is what is it Hippocrates says? Let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food. We definitely are what we eat, and as soon as we start paying a lot more attention to it, I think the prevention is a lot more accurate. Preventative medicine is the way to go forward, rather than waiting until it's too late and having to fight this cancer being one illness that's caused through diet-related prolonged toxicity, really.
Okay, now you talk about, say something quite interesting there is about toxic thoughts. Now that is a bit controversial. Can you tell us what you mean by that? Because I have a kind of an idea what you mean. You're saying is that sometimes your mind can go off in a direction which is actually not good for your health, and you sometimes we lose it, don't we? All of us are a bit like that sometimes.
Well, I'm a firm believer that thoughts create our reality. And I have a lot of friends that are practicing NLP, neuro-linguistic programmers, that use this technique, which is neuro-linguistic programming, basically telling yourself what it is you want your body to do. So, for example, stop smoking or lose weight or do more exercise, be more productive. And it's literally self-talk. So you're talking yourself into a position of being more confident, and it's used a lot in media and advertising to sell us stuff. But in a positive way, it's used to prolong good health. So if we're always having these thoughts of not being good enough, not doing enough, having to work hard or not getting anywhere, underachievement, I mean, there's so many thought loops and cycles that we go through in our own mind that we use all the time. Things like, I'm always doing this, I'm always breaking things, I never get what I want, I'm too fat, I'm in debt, I'm not... And it's like, if we repeat these thoughts over and over again, our subconscious is absorbing them and believing them.
Yes, you're right. And I think actually one of the things that is important to try and do is to identify ways you want to change, and rather than sort of expect that you might drift there, is actually to tell yourself to take control a little bit and to tell yourself, I do want to change. I mean, particularly this is difficult, isn't it, when it comes to addiction, Vicky?
Definitely. And speaking from my own experience, I mean, I'm not saying I've always been a clean diet. I'm not saying that even now my diet's completely clean. I mean, I treat myself, maybe that's the wrong word. I eat things, I drink, I've recently just stopped smoking, but it's only in the past few weeks, so I'm not going to brag about that too much. But it's a path. Everybody's on their own journey, and as we walk along our journey, we realise that the things that are bad for us don't make us feel good. And once we start dropping them out of our lives and we feel better for it, it's a real common sense light bulb moment of going, oh, okay, I'm going to stop hurting myself, I'm going to stop damaging myself. And so many of us are in self-harm mode, whether it be drugs, alcohol, media, kind of fast food, binge drinking on the weekend, sex addiction. There's all different things that we can punish ourselves with, and it all comes down to self-worth. And it sounds a little bit cheesy, but actually it makes a lot of sense, and a lot of us get to that aha light bulb moment. And there's a lot of authors out there and a lot of YouTube documentaries and things like that that explore self-worth and positive talk. And like I said at the beginning, I definitely encourage all of you listeners to do their own due diligence and own research, because what you stumble across is completely perfect for you.
You see, the interesting thing is, nowadays we've got this thing called the internet, and a doctor might tell us something, and we can actually hold a piece of paper printed out off of an expert site on the internet and say, well, sorry, you're wrong.
Well, one thing that I learned when I did my anatomy and physiology, when I was doing the massage, was you go to the doctors, you tell him what you've got, say you've got a stomach ache, and he tells you what you've just said to him back in Latin. So you say, I've got a stomach ache, and he says, you've got gastroenteritis, which means inflamed stomach. So he just tells you what you've just told him in Latin, which is hilarious, really, and then prescribes you antibiotics, which then affects your gut flora and then give you other problems. And it's like the side effects for these tablets that the doctors are giving out like sweets are just vast. Whereas there's so many plant medicines out there that have no side effects or very few side effects, but because there isn't a patent on them, and because the doctor and the big pharmaceutical industries aren't earning money out of that, then they don't want to suggest the natural route, which that to me is the biggest, I don't really even know the word, because it's just, it's awful what we're doing to people when the natural cure is available, it's free. And yet people aren't being taught how to harness the herbs that are around us. Instead, we're just kind of quick fix, give us a tablet. And I believe the doctors need to start taking responsibility for this.
Okay. Also, before you go, Vicky, can you just give us one tip around cancer particularly? One thing you think that would help people avoid getting it in the first place? I think once you've got it, it's difficult to know what to do. And then when we're not trying to say what you should do in that sort of situation, but what's your one tip to avoid it?
Nutrition. Nutrition is an amazing tool that we all use, we all eat every day, and to alkalize the body. Cancer grows in an acidic environment. And I listened to a study about 12 months ago, and it said that 100% of people with cancer, no matter what cancer it is, have candida, so thrush, so a yeast infection. And I just had a light bulb moment. Of course, we eat bread that's yeast-based, and then we feed it sugar. And it's like, this is where we breed in this acidic environment, which is perfect for cancer to grow. And there's a lot of research on acidic alkaline diet. Short-term fix is to use bicarbonate soda. You can either drink bicarbonate soda or soak your feet or get in the bath in bicarbonate soda. But I'd suggest, if to do your due diligence, is to buy some litmus paper, which is the pH testing paper off eBay. It's about £2 or £3. And just test whether your body's alkaline or acid and adjust it accordingly, and just do your due diligence and check out what recipes we have on the internet and what foods are alkalis, which are green juices, green leafy vegetables, and avoid things like heavy sugars, alcohol, and that in itself is a massive tip on how to avoid cancers in the future.
Okay, and where would you recommend people look online, Vicky?
Truthjuice.co.uk has an amazing list of links, including other subjects as well as this, but there's a whole heap of health topics relating to diet, nutrition, and Natural News is another great one. PST, Paradigm Shift TV, They've got some brilliant documentaries. Clive DeCarle, who does Ancient Purity.
Now, you better just give us a spell that out a little bit.
Oh, Ancient Purity. I think it's ancientpurity.com. And it's Clive D-E, another word, C-A-R-L-E. Ancient Purity. He's an amazing nutritionalist that's based down in Stonehenge. And another amazing nutritionist is Philip Weeks. He's another speaker we've had talk at Truth Juice. And the information is out there. It's just searching the right things. And like you say, the internet is just so vast. We've got everything we need there. It's just giving it the time to have a look, really.
Okay, Vicky Hensher, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Lovely, and thank you for everything you do as well, Tony. Brilliant. Thanks for everything you do to empower people to know about this alternative information.
All right, love. Thanks very much. I also ought to mention also that something called the Raphael Centre in Tunbridge in Kent, which is also another very interesting and incredibly successful alternative cancer treatment centre. So, Vicky Hensher, thanks very much for joining us.
I think we will get to the stage where the alternative is the only alternative. I really do, because it has all the answers there. So thank you, Tony, and best of luck with your show. Thank you.
Cheers, Vicky.
Bye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, we've just seen the long Glastonbury weekend, but the festival is nothing like the free festivals like Stonehenge, set up by the Travellers and the Peace Convoy in the 1960s, which Glastonbury copied and was set up by Winston Churchill's daughter Arabella in the 1970s, was Glastonbury. But over the years, that Glastonbury festival has become less and less free, more and more expensive. More like the hard-nosed, business-minded society it was set up originally to challenge. Stonehenge Free Festival, however, was stopped by the Thatcher and the Tories in the 1980s when the government ordered the police to destroy the Traveller convoy on their way to Stonehenge in the so-called Battle of the Beanfield. Anyway, Steve Muggeridge has tracked the festival scene over the years. He's been to many of them, from Stonehenge through the Glastonbury Greenfields to an event which is probably as close as you'll get to the original West Country festival ideals from the 60s. He's a director of the annual Green Gathering, which takes place just over the Old Severn Bridge in Chepstow, the first week in August every year. And I spoke to him about how the festival scene has changed over the last half century.
My name's Steve Muggeridge. I'm a director of the Green Gathering and formerly a director of the Big Green Gathering. And I've been going to festivals since the early 80s, starting with the Stonehenge Free Festival. My first introduction to that was really as an exposition of social anthropology, whereby the counterculture said that they could do things different to the mainstream, and I wondered whether we could. And therefore, ever since, I think, in terms of forging community, we sought not to replicate the inequities in larger society.
Tell us a bit about those early Stonehenge festivals, though, or certainly the first ones you went to. What were they actually like?
Well, they were remarkably well organised for having no official organisation. And I think the mistake is to think there's anything such as a free festival. Although they were termed free festivals, there was a core of people that spent a lot of time and energy putting them together. So certainly there wasn't a price on the gate. But there was a committed community of people that felt that not only should people gather in the sacred spaces, which is our commonwealth, as subject citizens, members of this nation, but also that we could construct alternative social structures. And I think that theme has maintained on a certain fringe of festivals.
Now, one of the things that immediately that comes to mind is things like eating, drinking, water supply, things like medical aid, that kind of thing. So how were those organised?
Well, the fact is they weren't. There is a certain amount of rose-tinted spectacle use with regard to retrospectives on the free festivals, because I would certainly say that the green events we have today, the Green Gathering in particular, is light years ahead of where the free festival movement was in terms of providing constructive alternatives, which is why we call our event currently Beyond Hedonism. Because we like to combine certain constructive themes along with people obviously relaxing and entertaining themselves, the theme being community. So back in the free festival days, being outside of the law at the time, there was very little sanitation and very little in the way of infrastructure to support the event. But nonetheless, we did managed to have events of up to 20,000 people without people dying or without outbreaks of disease, which just proves the strength of community. What you find is that the community will rally and organise itself in an informal way if a structure isn't imposed on it. And the balance we like to strike is to have a focus on community, DIY and stakeholdership in the event, rather than the imposition of various infrastructural necessities. While it is true the Licensing Act has made life more expensive for festivals, it has also had the benefit of requiring them to provide certain infrastructure that I think people appreciate.
Tell us how large groups of people, when they come together, do this self-organising. Is it just when they realise, for example, that there is no water, that they have to go and get some water? Or how do large numbers of people, when they come together in these ways, almost like a sort of old-fashioned flash mob in a way, how do they actually get organised? Or have we forgotten how to do that?
We have been collectively disempowered to remember that, in fact, we do have the power to organise our own communities. It's a paradox that mainstream society complains about a lack of community, which is precisely what we foster at our sort of events, yet they have never really attracted the support of the mainstream, quite frequently the opposite. Sometimes empowering a community can be dangerous as far as certain powers that be are concerned, in terms of people actually empowering themselves. And what we find is that given a group of people, there will nearly always be characters of ability that will rise to the challenge. So these issues are rather problem-solving oriented. There is no water. How do we obtain a wholesome supply? There is no sanitation. How do we ensure that the well-being or the encampment or the event isn't threatened by sanitation issues? In many ways, some of the old medieval armies had very similar problems. More people used to die in those camps than ever in battle. Same applies. They're very practical problems. Now, the slight risk with this is that you can get charismatic authority. And there used to be a phrase called the tyranny of structurelessness. So within a community, although there are cohering individuals that will bring a degree of structure and order and coherence to that community, it is always advisable that there are some basic articles of understanding. And what we tend to find is that there's a very large common denominator amongst people wanting to achieve the same objectives. And since largely the objectives are the benefit of the community, and that has got many strands, but it's a large community, that will incarnate. The progressive nature of what we do is to try and institutionalise the empowerment of the community. So as an event ourselves, we've always had a strong emphasis on the accountability of the leaders, directors of the company, leaders of the organisation, the event organisers. A lot of mainstream commercial festivals effectively just put on a show, take the money and turn people away, which is why I was at a conference recently where they were debating why they had such a big problem with abandoned tents. We do not have that problem because people consider themselves to have a stake in the community and therefore would not leave litter like that. So really, it's a matter of stakeholdership.
Okay, going back to the Stonehenge Festival, I know eventually it was banned, wasn't it, nationally, I think, by the Thatcher government. Tell us a little bit about how that happened and, you know, the attack on the peace convoy, which was, for those that weren't around at the time, was a kind of group of people living in mobile homes and vehicles.
Well, yes, the Battle of the Beanfield, as it is known in legend, and was the result in 1985 of an attempt to stage the Stonehenge Free Festival. In 1984, ownership of the land around Stonehenge changed from the National Trust to English Heritage. At that time, the chair of the English Heritage body, Lord Montague Bewley, was specifically against the whole concept of festivals. So it wasn't so much the authorities on a national basis, but the immediate custodians of the land that made that difference. However, I think it needs to be in the context of a lot of activity by large groups of people that were seen to be lawless, which is not true. They just cohere to different principles to the mainstream society. And by the time we get to the Battle of the Beanfield, in fact, there had been a lot of history between the local authorities, the police forces in Wiltshire and Hampshire in particular. So not only was that to prevent the Free Festival occurring, but there was also a degree of settling of scores. the fact is that the Battle of the Beanfield was no such thing. It was what was termed at the time a trashing. A large convoy of over 120 vehicles got caught in a side road and was directed into a field. Thereupon, it was set upon by police, MOD policemen, all sorts of different authorities. Hundreds of people rounded up. Very few people were charged. They were lodged in prisons throughout the Southwest. As a result of that, there were many court cases on the lawfulness of the action. And whatever the outcome of those cases, it was never repeated.
Tell us about your experience or experience of people that you know of that day.
There was a film made at the time. It was taken by ITN. And it was so controversial that they did not actually screen it. Even the ITN camera crews were shocked by what they found. And there were vehicles on fire. Pregnant women were being dragged out of buses with their children through broken glass. There was every sort of abuse of power you can imagine. How no one died there is a miracle. Essentially, it was a police force out of control. That was the end of the Stonehenge Free Festival as such. But what that became is an extended campaign by the authorities at the time to create a new enemy within. We're looking at the context in the mid-80s of the miners' strike and a government that were looking for a way to demonise an internal opposition to justify their political agenda. Once they'd moved on from the miners, this was a target they felt would not be able to resist, hence terms medieval brigand and similar were used. In fact, by atomising one large event, they scattered those groups into lots of smaller events, and in the decades since, a lot of those groups have evolved, some quite progressively. So the actual irony is that although they stopped one free festival, they started many, many other small ones.
And what about the modern-day version of Stonehenge? Because there is a gathering, and also the Glastonbury Festival, which is now much more famous and probably more commercialised. How's Glastonbury, to begin with, changed over the years?
Glastonbury always used to be considered a sister festival to Stonehenge. In fact, at the time, Stonehenge was considered to be a little more frontline because Glastonbury always did have more facilities. It wasn't considered, perhaps, a softer sort of event. And certainly it shared the same principles. My involvement is still with the Greenfields at Glastonbury, and I would say that those Greenfields have maintained that tradition. The rest of the event, however, is very far from that tradition. And if it were not for the Greenfields, I think most people could conclude that Glastonbury would have lost its way very badly. But it does really rather depend on why you go to an event. And what we find is that although bands and entertainment attracts many people, fundamentally, if you ask people why they go to an event, it is because they find a sense of community and belonging there amongst their peers, which they do not find in their hometowns.
And what about Stonehenge? How's that changed in its new incarnation?
Well, the gathering at Stonehenge really is a very temporary matter, and I think there are probably more people now attending the solstice than that actually attended the free festival. I think the figures I heard today from last night were about 36,000 people. Stonehenge Free Festival at its peak was in the region of 20,000, although there were no tickets and no counting. So therefore, there are more people going to the Stones now than there ever were. Ironically, the whole experience of the Stonehenge Free Festival and since has actually augmented its reputation. But with the places iconic like that, it was always meant to attract people. It still attracts people. It's always been something of a wonder to the festival movement that the authorities spent so much time protecting ancient sites where they don't normally have such a regard for treble SIs, which had always made certain members of the community wonder what it is that was so special about these iconic representations of our culture and history that meant they could not be available to the people, because ultimately all these things are a representation of our culture and history and should be part of our commonwealth.
Well, I can certainly remember as a child, my parents were driving down to the West Country along the A303. We stopped at Stonehenge and there are pictures of us just sort of sitting on the stones. This is from, I think, the late 1960s. But what about the difference in... Because obviously these sorts of sites do attract people. The Free Festival is very different to what experience people are getting as the Stonehenge experience today if they're wanting to go to one of these iconic events?
There are many different motivations for people gathering at the Stones. Obviously, there is the experience of a lovely summer morning sunrise, which I believe they may have had on this occasion. On many other occasions, there are not. There is also a gathering of people at the winter solstice, which is not as well attended for obvious reasons. The Salisbury Plain can be unfriendly at that time of year, and certainly the same numbers are not present there. But I think people are curious about the Stones in themselves because they're iconic. They're curious about the phenomena whereby tens of thousands of people go to watch the sun come up. And some of them, of course, are the old-timers that remember the old days, as you mentioned, when we used to have free access to the Stones, which I might add never resulted in them being damaged at all. There were, unfortunately, towards the end of the Stonehenge Festival period, a couple of incidents where the Stones were not treated with the respect that they should have been. But even in those days, probably a minority of people actually came to understand what the Stones were about. And again, today, I think a large number of people are coming because it's a social phenomena and an interesting party and a good community liaison point with a lot of their friends and fellow travellers. How many people there are actually aware or committed to the principles or some of the religions or practices behind the Stones, it's hard to say. But in fact, there is another ceremony after the public enter the following night in which various groups like the Order of Bards, Obates and Druids and the British Order of Druids conduct ceremonies that are not open to the public.
Okay, what about this? Just the general fact that the travelling lifestyle seems to have been virtually outlawed now in Britain. If you go around many of the roads in Somerset and Gloucestershire and all over the country, there are wide verges where travellers of all sorts, modern travellers and gypsies, used to stop. That seems to have almost completely gone. So it seems that the Battle of the Beanfield was, in a way, one of the most important, an important cultural change in the country. I wonder if you think that that's there's anything any real significance to the fact that now it's very difficult to live that sort of lifestyle.
It is, but in some ways it's actually easier now. I am certainly back in the 80s and maybe earlier, it was not uncommon to hear of small encampments or people parked up being attacked by vigilantes, and that could be anything from firebombs to shotguns. That was not uncommon. This does not happen these days. You do not see so many people on the side of the road. And at this point, I might add that within the travelling scene, there are many different strands of traveller, some of which are ethnic, some of which are traditional, and some of which are far more recent and ideological, all of which have their own customs and traditions. But the fact is that that lifestyle has not decreased, it's increased. The irony of all that activity was to perpetuate it. And in fact, now we're seeing 20, 30 years on, another generation of people taking to the roads, converting vehicles. There are probably more people than ever doing this, but less obviously. What happened after the park-ups that were available and the free festival scene was atomized is a lot of people sorted out small locations, farms, other places where they had permission from the owners to be. So it is bigger than it ever was, but it's accommodated by more legitimate and traditional sources. So there's no need to be on the side of the road. In fact, if you are on the side of the road, you're very unlikely to be disturbed these days. So in many ways, life is a lot easier. But only because one of the consequences of Stonehenge and what happened back then is people required to become organised. In a very real way, a certain anarchic principle informed the old free festivals. After the Battle of the Beanfield, it became obvious to people that they needed to organise politically and otherwise in order to maintain any sort of existence. So I would say, in fact, it's thriving. There are still new generations of people coming into that scene, and whereas other passions have come and gone, this perpetuates itself. That's because it's allied to some underlying and profound and enduring themes that reflect the relationship that the people have with their land. And that will be that information will be passed from generation to generation. So I don't think, in fact, the consequence of the Beanfield was to actually thwart or reduce it. They changed the nature of it. They required it to be more organised. And I think there's a phrase, don't get mad, get even. And people got smart. They got more organised. So I say that there's an actual traceable line from free festival organiser to company director. Essentially, over the years, so much legislation has been passed that most people involved with that scene at the time, who still organise events, have now find themselves in the role of company directors. And of course, the irony in that is that, in a sense, I suppose you could say the system has asserted some sort of control, because those directors are required to function under company law, health and safety legislation, and the rest. But nonetheless, the essence and the vibe and the community of the Free Festival spirit are still maintained in any number of the green and fringe festivals. Don't look for it at the big commercial events, because they were never predicated on that. They're just straight commercial exchanges, there's nothing more to it.
How does this all fit into the Green Gathering then?
Well, in my view, and I've been with the Gathering since the first event back in 1994, the Green Gatherings stem from a previous history of Green Gatherings earlier than that, which were small protest camps at the time. The Big Green Gathering, formed in 1994, was essentially to gather green activists and what I would call various elements of the counterculture together in one large event. And today the Green Gathering is still, as far as I'm concerned, one of the only real positive expositions of the counterculture in this country. There are many forms of resistance or response to authority structures, but they don't necessarily amount to a counterculture. So the entire purpose of the Green Gathering was to gather like-minded people from the counterculture, from the green movement, from the travelling movement, and focus on how they could support each other as a community, and how we could take forward various ideas about ecology, community. In fact, the mainstream has been catching up. The concepts of resilience and community, microgeneration, and other features that are now on the lips of civil servants were the sort of social anthropological dynamics we were exploring 20 or 30 years ago. Fact is, we've moved on, the mainstream has not. Although there has been a movement of the mainstream towards a counterculture, in that some of the principles and concepts we were discussing and talking about then were alien to the mainstream. Now they are part of the mainstream. However, the risk is that with concepts and ideas being adopted by the mainstream, they also become watered down, they become diffused, possibly to the point of meaninglessness. So therefore, people can use sustainability as a word, and it can mean many things to different people.
What about fracking, though? Because that's come along. It's almost like something that mainstream politics has taken up. It's almost like it's gone round the green movement and come round from the other side. It's almost like a flanking movement. So what do you make of that? I mean, do you think the green movement is able to defend the environment from the frackers?
To an extent. Fracking is just the latest example of an obsession with ever-increasing amounts of energy use that has no connection with sustainability. So rather than adopt the principles of renewable energy, microgeneration, community-based and owned supply, they are still effectively in the grip of the powerful energy lobbies that still wish to centrally produce and distribute energy. And indeed, most of our lifestyles now require more and more energy. So fracking is just the latest incarnation of that general need to search for more and more power without evaluating what the power is used for or whether it is indeed necessary. So as a response to that, activist groups support each other now as they did in the past. But, you know, I emphasize this is only the latest. In the last 20 or 30 years, we've seen a lot of different passions and trends in terms of what people have been protesting against. Back in the early 90s, it was roads. More recently, it's been other subjects. Now it's fracking. Essentially, the same community dynamics apply, in that groups of empowered and aware and informed citizens are attempting to bring some form of democratic accountability to vested interests that otherwise will take no responsibility for the damage they do to the environment or the community. And this is what we find time and time again. Private gain is subsidised by public cost. And that is half the issue. No one can give the assurances that if the groundwater supply is contaminated, if damage is done, that it will be anything other than the taxpayer that picks that up. So in terms of the likely success of resistance from fracking, that's unclear. In a sense, it is now twinned with geopolitical dynamics, especially with the recent troubles in the Ukraine. So I think it's going to be more difficult than it had been to stop that, because there is an insatiable need to produce more fossil fuels. And at the same time, there's fracking. There's every chance that the Arctic National Park will be infringed by Russian exploration. Climate change means more and more marginal energy sources will become accessible. So we hope it can be stopped in this country, but that is, as ever, an asymmetrical fight. You've got under-resourced and small groups of citizens banding together against some quite powerful interests. However, it would not be the first time that small community groups have defeated powerful lobbies. People gathering together, empowering themselves and organising is always a very, very powerful force. We rather hope that the whole fracking concept is finessed by a change in policy in terms of energy generation. But until that happens, fracking or any other similar non-sustainable form of generating energy on a macro scale will just repeat themselves. It'll be fracking today, it'll be something else tomorrow. We'll have to, as a society, we have to determine how we more equitably distribute resources of all sorts, and that includes energy. Which is, of course, counterintuitive to our culture that now charges more devices than they ever thought were possible, even 10 years ago.
OK, finally, back to the green gathering. If people come along, what can they expect to find there?
Well, they can expect to find many things. We say it's a festival beyond hedonism, i.e. that to us a festival is an exposition of community, it's an exposition of ideas, and so therefore not just about entertainment. However, we do like to entertain, so you will find music there, not mainstream commercial bands, but very good musicians nonetheless. Again, all music and all elements of the event are powered by wind and sun, not even biodiesel. We do not have any biodiesel generators at all. And you will find crafts in which you are able to carve with wood or stone, or many other forms of craft. Again, part of sustainability is keeping ancient crafts alive so that when the time comes that we need to have those skills available, that they have not been lost. And until recent times, there was a chance a lot of these skills would have been lost. So you'll find craft, you'll find permaculture, you'll find a very healthy debating centre in the Green Forum, and that has what we call a transition and campaign zone that sits around that, in which many different groups will bring their cause to your attention. We also have what I consider one of the best Earth Mysteries area in the entire festival circuit, where we have specialist international speakers speak on all sorts of elements of mysticism and history, what people might call Albion, ancient myth, new energy systems. There's something there for everyone. We call it a family event because, in our experience, families feel that their children are safe. We have very little antisocial behaviour. We have very little presence by authority figures because the community is strong and therefore will be able to regulate itself. You know, I once remarked to a visiting community police officer that we did not need to fine people to have no litter on site. It was the strength of the community investing in itself and realising it had a stake. So therefore, there is no litter. And of course, we recycle. We have probably the most stringent recycling system of any event, with up to 16 different categories of recycling. So you can find permaculture, crafts, earth energies, a very good healing area, campaigns and entertainment at the Green Gathering.
And just remind us where and when it is.
The Green Gathering is at Chepstow in Piercefield Park, which is a beautiful 18th century landscape park, complete with ruined 17th century mansion, flying temples, and a wondrous view over both Seven Bridges. And we have the old and the new on the site that's very ancient, complete with its own hill fort, and has obviously been the centre for gathering for many millennia, although it seems that perhaps for the last half century the site's been a bit neglected. So we were very happy to be the first people to use that site to gather people together again in a long while. And now it seems that that site has attracted other events. We like to feel that yet again we pioneered another space that will be available for people to use. And we would very much recommend you come along between the 31st of July and the 3rd of August.
That was Steve Muggeridge, who's been tracking the festival scene and going along to many of these West Country festivals over the years, from Stonehenge through the Glastonbury Greenfields, which he now helps to organise, to an event which is probably as close as you'll get to the original West Country Festival ideals. That is the annual Green Gathering, which he's a director of. It takes place just over the old Severn Bridge in Chepstow the first weekend in August. And that was me chatting to him about how the festival scene has changed over the last half century. And that's all for this week. Dialect is a Bristol's first weekly podcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from Dialect Radio, oneword.co.uk. Thanks to our studio engineer, Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol broadband co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. Or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk on the net. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
Belongs in the hands of people.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. The dollar buys and nickels worth. Banks are going bust. We know things are bad, worse than bad.
Bad.
They're crazy, 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 crazy.
10 seconds to commercial.
Sometimes extreme behavior can be the warning sign of a mental illness. Learn to see the sickness.
The President of the United States!
Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave.
The sickness.
Regrettably,
bloodshed.
We now believe
strife.
That only force
riot.
Will make him leave.
Right!
I am certain our cause is just, a gallon of gas, and I am certain our cause is moral, loss of life. And I am certain our cause is right.
Give me the goddamn money. A new world order.
I don't know.
It's going to be all right tonight.
Lying.
Again.
I'm from the United States of Kiss My Ass.
Stupidity.
Again.
Kind of demoralizing the whole country.
Corruption. Again.
Don't hate the media. Become the media.
Power. It's up to you.
Choice.
It's up to you.
Change the world.
It's up to you.
Please do your part.
Truth is,
television is not the truth. Television is a goddamn amusement park.
Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave. Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave.
The protesters are a tiny but vocal minority. The American people overwhelmingly support the President of the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen, how do you feel?
Bum, you get a job.
The operation of the machine becomes so obvious that just
It's the right thing to do.
It's up to you.
What's yours?
It's the right thing to do.
It's up to you.
How do you feel?
It's the right thing to do.
It's up to you.
It's the right thing to do.
It's up to you.
Let me tell you
what it is.
Power.
It's up to you.
You.
Up to you.
Choice.
It's up to you.
Up to you.
You.
Change the world.
It's up to you.
Up to you.
Power!
Do what's right.
It's up to you.
You.
One more time.
Power.
It's up to you.
It's the right thing to do.
What's your
choice?
It's up to you.
It's the right thing to do.
How do you feel?
Change the world.
It's up to you.
It's the right thing to do. Do what's right.
It's up to you.
It's the right thing to do.
Oh, yeah.
What a group of kids we've sent out into the world.